Okay, I'm going to talk today about the Eric Thien and its influence, primarily its influence on Downing, other buildings, and my work as well. The Eric Thien is on the north side of the Acropolis, built between 421 and 406 BC. The sculptor and mason was Phidias, who was also worked on the Parthenon. It's an interesting building. I mean, unusual for a classical building in that it's very asymmetrical. As you can see here, there are porticos at different levels. There's the caryatic frieze, the columns at different heights. And that's partly because it's on quite an interesting bit of geology that is on different levels. And it is, it was the shrine for both Poseidon and Athena. It's supposed to be the spot where they met and nearly came to blows. And there's a crack in the rock that is supposedly Poseidon's trident. And there was a sacred olive tree for Athena. It was also the site of the mythical king, King Erechtheos. So it has these different roles, and scholars sort of disagree about which bit was for which shrine. But really, I'm not sort of too interested in its symbolism. My interest is in the architecture of it, and primarily the Ionic order here, which is sort of one of the most influential and beautiful Ionic orders of classical architecture. And interestingly, it's quite a curious building in that, despite the fact it's got a lot of... does this do the light? No. Sorry, I'm just trying to do... Does it have a light on this? Yes, it does. Here we go. It has this very classical portico and then a very plain wall. You'd expect a normal, like a Roman temple, to have it symmetrical both sides. You wouldn't just have a blank wall like that. It became a sort of... When Greeks started to be opened up in the mid-18th century, it became a sort of great interest to architects, and they did reconstructions of what it was like. Originally, it was painted. It was very brightly coloured. Countless architects have measured it and done drawings. These are just some French drawings of the 19th century, which just sort of document what it was like. Very beautiful Ionic order, which has this very distinctive collar with a lotus pattern, egg and dart, galoche, and then this fantastic volute, which is, if you look at a conventional Ionic order, they don't have nearly so many veins running around. And also the way that the veins scoop down in the middle, it almost looks like sort of cloth. The Ionic order was seen as the female column, and it's supposed to be a sort of clothed woman. And so this would be a kind of architectural formalization of the clothes she was wearing. Yes, more egg and dart on the abacus here. The base has a galoche pattern here. And these are all very early examples of these types of ornament, and fluted. It's also a very thin order relative to a Roman Ionic. It's 9.5 diameters high, so its width to height is 9.5, and the Roman equivalent would be 9, which makes quite a difference. Yes, there's also the caryatic porch, which I'm not going to talk about, but has had a huge influence. And this is the pilaster capital, which goes next to the column. When you don't have a round column and you want a square one, this is the capital they had, which is different from what the Romans would have done later, where they would have got put a capital on the corner. And this is the door. You can see the lotus pattern, Beden Reel, Eggendart, everything is ornamented. And this is what people in the mid-18th century would be expecting to see from an Ionic order. The Ionic order here, unlike the Erechtheian, is made out of four corners. With the Erechtheian, these volutes are flat, and then they join each other here. If I just go back. So you can see that it looks like that on the side, and it's got this flat front. This one is a corner. It's just this volute here. In order to allow a front face on both the front and the side, they had to canter this one at a 45-degree angle so that you can see both faces. I mean, it's an extra lecture in its own right, but the architects of the English 18th century just opted for this order always, because you get into so many problems with sides of buildings showing the sides of capitals. So they just thought, we'll just do a four-faced one. But very different from what the Erechtheian is very different from what they would used to see. And also the cornice here has modillions in it. It doesn't, sometimes it's ornamented, sometimes not. And this capital comes from Rome, because no one in England visited Greece, although I'm sure there probably were, but very few. So it came from Palladio's Roman measurements, and then Scamozzi, who was Palladio's pupil, translated them and made them his own. And then Inigo Jones, the English architect, met Scamozzi, and basically English architecture up to 1750-ish, so from the Civil War, 1750, is Inigo Jones's taste. That's the kind of ballpark thing. The basic grammar, obviously there was the Baroque and so on, but Inigo Jones used this capital on the Banqueting House and the Queen's House in Greenwich, and in tablatures like this. He also had an annotated copy of Palladio, and so that was what everyone had. With the opening up of Greece, which happened for a combination of reasons, Greece became more accessible, and also with the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolution, the conventional places to go on the Grand Tour were more difficult to get to: Venice, Rome, and Paris. So it was really a sort of a circumstance of the time, and there was also a feeling that among artists that effectively we'd been shortchanged, because all we had was the Roman work, and the Romans were a kind of brutal, warring type, and the Greeks were these wonderful philosophers and writers and everything else. In kind of Platonic terms, the Romans were a shadow of what the Greeks were. And so for artists, it was very exciting. And this image here by Arink, painted in about 1880, shows the crowning of Homer, and you've got Michelangelo, Raphael, Poussin. So they all kind of ultimately come back to the source, which is ancient Greece. Also, at the same time, mid-18th century, there was beginning to be a reaction against the Baroque, partly because the Baroque was the architecture of the church and the monarchs, and maybe just the evolution of fashion. In Baroque sculpture, this is Bernini's David, it's all about the movement and capturing, this is David actually throwing the sling, and you can see his expression on his face, he's biting his lip, and it's all very intense and ecstatic and so on. The way they reacted to that, sculptors like Canova of the next generation, it was all about serenity and peace. And you would always have people after the action in contemplative sort of positions. And this also related to the difference between Roman and Greek architecture, where the Romans used arches and the Greeks used post and lintel. And the feeling was that the trabeated, the post and lintel, was a very peaceful structure to look at and just sort of as an idea. It was a straight with two things down. Whilst the arch, in Hindu philosophy, they say the arch never sleeps because every stone is pushing against each other the whole time, and which sort of chimes with that idea of the Baroque being this struggling and rather than this kind of serene Greek feel. Concurrent with this, and this is part of a sort of philosophical mood with people like Leger, whose idea that man in his natural state is perfect and the noble savage, that he would make his place in paradise and live off food, they wouldn't fight, and that everything that's kind of bad about us is because of our civilization and mechanized society and whatever else. And these ideas came through into architecture with Leger, who was a Jesuit priest. And he had this idea of Adam's house in paradise, which was a structure where everything was essential. So the columns hold up the building, the roof is a pediment, but it isn't a decorative pediment, it needs to be the shape he is. So really Leger is the sort of first modernist in a way to say that we don't need all this ornament, everything should be essential in architecture. And this was a reaction against the Baroque and church architecture. If you look at St. Peter's, none of these columns actually do anything, it's just a wall with columns stuck on the front. And then this pediment gable end is just a bit of ornament, it's not a roof. And, well, likewise, you've got a dome there, which is something that's Roman. And also a dome has movement. And along with this, and I can sort of have a lot of sympathy in a way for the reaction against the Baroque. This is Versailles, and Louis XIV was the ultimate Baroque king, very lavish, couldn't get enough gold. Plus ça change. As the Baroque kept going, sort of unbridled, with the Catholic Church and the monarchs and everyone else, it was getting more and more sort of ornate and mad. And this is a church. I can't remember which one. I think it's Otterburn in southern Germany. And it was just getting absolutely mad. I quite like this, but it's it was. I think there was a time to rein in the taste, and I think that also, sort of, from an ideological point of view, architecture is often about kind of nailing your colours to the mast. Are you, a Catholic monarchist, or are you part of the Enlightenment? And I think that was a very much their sort of attitude. Whoops. That's just a bit of detail of Rococo. And this is just sort of meaningless ornament that's just sort of wafted out wherever they like. Along with this, at the same time, the whole world was opening up. People were starting to go to China. And people were doing Chinese architecture, which really, it was a kind of Baroque, Rococo version of Chinese architecture, but related, didn't really relate to actually what Chinese buildings looked like, but it was an idea of... and architects were looking for something really fundamental to sort of get their teeth into, because it just seemed so sort of whimsical. Likewise, this is a Gothic temple at Stowe, where in days gone by, Gothic was, if you think of the building of Chartres, the whole community built that together, and the idea is probably completely false, that it was a kind of joyful building of this wonderful religious structure. And then, you know, by the mid-18th century, the Dukes of Buckingham just liked the idea of a temple that looked sort of vaguely spooky, so they put one of these up. But it could be Chinese, it could be French, and they reacted to this. So people started measuring the buildings of Athens. And the first person to do this was Julien David Leroy, and he published his measurements in 1758. He did this after 3 months of measuring, and he did it pretty quickly. And the reason was that is because his English rivals also wanted to produce a book, Stuart and Rivette, but they took a lot longer to produce it. These were the first measured drawings of the Erechtheion, pretty accurate, really. And here we are, you can see it all there. You've got the capital with its bolster on the side, all very well represented, a section. Interestingly, Leroy didn't want it to be copied. He saw it as recording it, and that very much architecture should be of its own period and its own time. Anyway, when Leroy had published his book, there was a lot of reaction because people were very invested in Roman architecture, and particularly Piranesi, who was a great Roman engraver, archaeologist, artist, architect. And he didn't like this threat to Rome being primary. Leroy said that Roman Ionic columns, Ionic capitals, are weak and defective. And it was this idea that Greece was the source and anything else was a crude representation of what was Greek. And this page that Piranesi did, he took a plate from Leroy and reproduced it. There's the Erechtheian capital again, and positioned lots of very unusual, elaborate, creative Roman capitals, many of which were reused in early Christian buildings, which he saw around them. And it was him saying, you know, you think Greece is so wonderful, but, you know, look what we got in Rome. And yeah. So you then had a period where people started to be influenced by Greek work, but with slightly insubstantial measurements from Leroy. In England, the first person to import Greek architecture was Adam at Austerley Park in 1761. And it's not a perfect representation of the Erechtheion, but it's a lot more like the Erechtheion than people in England would have been expecting. The type of six-column portico of the generation before would look like this, which is at Stowe. And you can see you've got the four-cornered Ionic. You've got a very steep pediment, which is about 26 degrees. The columns are a lot stubbier than Adam's ones. So it has a sort of smell of ancient Greece, but it isn't a kind of scholarly version. And in Sion House, in the anteroom, which is also 1760s, he does a sort of mishmash of Roman and Greek work. So this is very Roman, as is that, but the capitals are quite a close representation of the Erechtheian capitals. You've got the galoche, you've got the egg and dart, you've got the ornate collar, you've got the volutes. Admittedly, this pattern in here was not part of the Erechtheian one. That's a Roman version, which probably he got from Piranesi, who he knew. But this bolster side is exactly the same as the Erechtheian. So I think Adam was trying to make a new style, which was based on historic precedents. But I don't think he was too fussed if it wasn't absolutely scholarly correct. Stuart and Rivette, who I mentioned earlier, Stuart had a very long grand tour and ending in 1755. And it took them until 1762 to get their first volume of their drawings out. And in that volume, there are a whole load of interesting temples, but the real big exciting ones, the Erechtheian and the Parthenon, aren't there. Interestingly, Stuart did his own version of the Erechtheian in St. James's, which is probably the first scholarly version of the Erechtheian portico. And it wasn't until 1787 that they produced volume two, which had the Parthenon and the Erechtheian in it, which is incredibly late compared to 20 years later than Loire. These are actually much better measurements, and you could use them and get a very true representation of the Erechtheian. They benefited from Loire publishing his book first, because they could sort of pick holes in it and improve it generally. And it's full of these sort of measurements, which he did. Stuart and Rivette and Loire weren't the only people to measure and look at the Acropolis. Wilkins went on a grand tour from 1801 to 1804. And he went round Sicily, Asia Minor, and ended up in Athens. He was going to do measured drawings of Athens. He did great measured drawings of the work that he'd seen in Pestum and Sicily and so on. But this is the only drawing he did of the Acropolis, which is the Erechtheian. He did a written account, which when he was there, he saw that Lord Elgin was measuring and drawing, well, not him, but his artists were all measuring and drawing the monuments. And he just thought it'd be pointless to measure them himself. So this is the only drawing he did. When he got back in 1804, and then Downing had a competition to design the college, and there were lots of very eminent architects as part of that competition. And Wilkins, as an ex-Cambridge recent graduate, was really, with no track record, went in for the competition and won it, slightly because of kind of the dilettante society and the Greekophiles trying to get him involved. And in a way, it was Downing trying something new, and it's the first bit of Greek revival in Cambridge, almost in England. And I think they were keen to be the first at it. Also, if you think back to this, when I was talking about the Baroque and the Catholic Church and the monarchs and so on, I think there must have been a feeling that they wanted to be on the side of the kind of Age of Enlightenment. And Wilkins very much wanted to build a new Acropolis. And it's almost as if you build the buildings, new Platos and Aristotles will emerge. So this is his, this is the dining room, which you all know well, which is a very good version of the Erechtheian. You can see the low pediment, which would have been quite shocking at the time. If you look at contemporary ones, they would have been far steeper. You can see this distinctive capital going around the corner, which just angles so that you get the flat face on the other side as well. He's got the base mouldings as well. Interestingly, that portico, he doesn't do it. On some he does, some he doesn't. The four-face thing. I suppose that's just because it sticks out one version. Sorry, it's a bit of a bad photo. Another thing I think he picked up on from the Erechtheian was these very blank walls. In that earlier slide, I had the portico and then the blank wall, which is a very, I think, a very Greek revival approach and very indebted to the Erechtheian. A Baroque architect or an earlier English architect wouldn't do that. If you had something like a portico like that on the end, you would have another portico here, you would have some coins, and the boldness of just doing a blank stone wall, I feel must have come out of that. Here's the capitals. You can see he's got the collar, the egg and dart, the galoche, and this distinctive volute decoration. Interestingly, he didn't ornament this with egg and dart. I wonder whether that is because it's done in Cretan stone, which is not the best stone for carving in the world, and so it's a bit abbreviated. It's incredible to have carved that in Cretan. This is one of the corner ones I was mentioning, so you get both, so you see both sides. But it is abbreviated. You haven't got the bead and reel here. You haven't got the egg and dart there. Could have been cost as well. Wilkins was keen to do a big Erechtheian building along here, which would have been amazing. And, you know, if the college ever think of doing it. I'm not going to name names, but yeah. Contemporary with Downing in America, the architect Benjamin Henry Latrobe did the Erechtheian portico for Baltimore Cathedral. He was employed by Jefferson, and he worked on the US Capitol building, and he also did the White House porticos, which is interesting because the White House porticos are very different. They're more like those corner Ionics I showed you initially, because he was imitating sort of colonial federal American style. Elgin, as everyone knows, took an awful lot from the Acropolis, including one of the columns from the Erechtheian, which has been replaced with a concrete one on site. And this is the one in the British Museum, which you can see any day. And it's a stunning piece of work. And you can actually see from this, it's done in marble, which means that you can carve it in so much more detail than Wilkins could in Cretan stone. You can see that egg and dart top to it. This is one of the corner ones. You can see the volute that just comes juts out. You've got the bead and reel, the decorative frieze around here, and the galoche. Wilkins sorry, not Wilkins, Elgin, took artifacts from the Acropolis from 1801 to 1812, and the British Museum bought this in 1816. So from 1816 onwards, it's very easy for someone to copy the Erechtheian, because you both have Loire, Stuart and Rivet, and also an example to look at. There are hundreds of copies of the Erechtheian. I'm just going to highlight some of the more significant ones. This one, and the 1820s was the big period for this Regency era. This is St. Pancras Church. This is done by a father and son team, Henry and William Inwood. And when they won the competition, the father, Henry, was in Athens, and he took moulds and got casts of the Erechtheian and brought them back to do this. So it's a very accurate example. He also has the Caryatic porch here as well. Here we are, and it's pretty much the same size as the Erechtheian, which is probably a consequence of having the casts, that he had to have it that size. Further afield, you have Schinkel, the great German architect in Berlin, in the Berlin Concert House in 1821, used the Erechtheian, and his Altmuseum, also in Berlin. He, like Adam, took a few liberties with it. It isn't exactly true to the historic example. Continuing on in England in the 1820s, 1825 to 1828, you've got St. Mark's Mayfair, and this is by Gandhi, who was brother of the famous illustrator who worked for John Soane. He was in the Society of Dilettante. He travelled in Greece. He was also a friend and collaborator of Wilkins. 1830s, you've got the US Treasury Building in Washington, D.C. This comes sort of full circle in a way. This is the Academy of Athens, 1859 to 1887. By Hansen, a pupil of Schinkel, who was a Danish architect. And it's slightly ironic that you've got a Danish architect working in Greece, giving them a Greek building. This is interesting because it picks up on the colour that was in the original Erechtheian. Downing's sort of love affair with the Erechtheian didn't end with Wilkins. When Edward Barry did the dining room. Edward Barry was son of the famous Charles Barry, and he did work at Downing, both the ends of the two Wilkins blocks and these columns in the dining room. He used the Erechtheian again. It's not as pure as Wilkins's version. Again, slightly in the spirit of Schinkel and Adam, he's made it his own a bit. Interestingly, on the end of the two Wilkins blocks, he did a portico where he did a very faithful copy of the Erechtheian pilasters. So I think slightly his work's been underestimated at Downing, really. And this is a very late example. This is the, I'm doing this chronologically, so it kind of puts the Downing story into a sort of context. This is the Pushkin Museum in Moscow, 1898 to 1912. Back to Downing. When Herbert Baker in the 1930s did his work, he did his version of the Erechtheian. You can see the capital has the decorative frieze. You've got the egg and dart, bead and reel, the galoche pattern. It's again, he's made it his own, and whether that, it's probably a sort of wanting to put his own stamp on Downing rather than any other reason. This is an interesting mix of Palladio and Greek. Likewise, he doesn't flute it. So there's quite a lot of his own taste there. You know, it doesn't have the level of ornamentation. Again, that could have been cost. If you go back to the this is much steeper. And when Alexander Scott in the 50s did the chapel block, he used the same capital and the same steep pediment, but the capitals are exactly the same, which is a mid-20th century version of the Erechtheion. And it is quite interesting in a way to think that this is right through the period. If you think of 50s architecture, how different this is and how kind of Downing just kept on with this style. This is a building I've worked on in London. This is the original building. It was a Regency building with a small portico like this. And the client had quite sort of opulent taste. And he wanted a sort of a portico just to give the building a bit of... He felt that if... Because we extended it. This is this wing here. The original building was this, which is by Nash. And then Lutyens built that on the side, just next to the London Mosque in Regent's Park. We made it symmetrical by adding another one on here. And then it just looked a bit sort of barrack-like. So then, actually, very late on in the day, we applied for planning permission to do this, and which was a great task. And when I designed it, I didn't want to do a kind of Herbert Baker mishmash of Palladio and ancient Greece. I wanted to get it absolutely as close to the Erechtheion as possible, which is probably quite an unfashionable thing to do because artists are supposed to be creative and so on. But I just thought it's such a beautiful capital, can't really be improved on, well, the whole order is. So that's what I did. And I had the advantage, obviously, of the British Museum capital, also lots of books. The one I used is this book called Norman's Parallel that has excellent measured drawings, sections through each bit. In order to set out this volute setting out doesn't work. So I had to use Palladio for that, but otherwise it was as close to the Erechtheion as I could. Obviously, I could go to the British Museum. These are my drawings I did. This is back in the day when I did hand drawings for construction. We're now fully cadded up, so this era is gone, unfortunately. So this is the working drawing, which I rendered afterwards. And you can see here the elevation. It's got the very thin 9.5 diameters high. I never like that capital, which has the which has that turn on it. So I put a pilaster on the end to avoid that. I'm not the only person who dislikes that. The architect chambers of Somerset House thought it was, didn't like it either. It's just unresolved, in my opinion. So if you can see on the plan, there's this blue of the existing building, and the red is what I put on. That's the front elevation. You've got a section, another section, another section, and the side elevation. This particular client, who, as I mentioned, likes a lot of ornament, but he had a problem with, I think for religious reasons, with representing figures and humans or animals or anything like that. So all ornament had to be plant-based. And he wanted some ornament in the frieze. And the original Erechtheion has some figures. And instead, I just did a band here, which is effectively the band that's in there, but just bigger. And then I put ornament in here, which he also wanted. It was enormous fun. This is a drawing I did of the Capitol, sort of thing I really enjoy doing, getting down to the absolute sort of nitty-gritty where you can sort of see, you do all the sections, and I quite enjoy how you can study how this line goes up as it goes round and also shrinks. What else? As you can see, I've done the full Eggendart here, Guiloche, Eggendart, Beedenreel, Waterleaf. It's got the flutes. And then you've got a section here, and then plans at different levels, so you can see these relate to different heights of the capital. And then we got it made, which is very exciting, actually, because the client couldn't afford to have it made in natural stone. And I don't think we would have got the detail. I mean, each one of those capitals would cost an absolute fortune. So we got it in cast stone, which is effectively concrete. And in order to do that, you have to make a mold. And this was made by a mold maker in Nottingham. And this is the Guiloche pattern for the base. And he knew nothing about classical architecture. It just done purely from the mouldings and from my drawings, which was, it was really exciting. Here it is in the workshop, the different, you've got the Guiloche, that's for the base. This is the middle bit of the capital. And there you've got the volute lying down there, and then that decorative collar. This is the pattern made up. And the pattern is the kind of most crisp thing because it then gets coated in rubber, and then the rubber gets coated in GRP, and then you pour in the concrete. And the cast is always cruder than this, so this is the most accurate part. And here's someone just cleaning it up before it got cast. And that's it, finally built. And here we are, that's where they are. And I think what I like about it is it's that capital has the way that light hits it. It's just a very beautiful way of breaking down light from this straight to that straight, in that the way that the light breaks down in this bit. And I think in a way this is slightly what a lot of contemporary architecture lacks, is that worrying about how light falls on things. And I think our brains like to see ornament because if you think about any natural habitat of a human being, a sort of forest or whatever, light would always be broken. And I think there's something in that reflected in this capital. Here we are, it's the front elevation. And I suppose I think one of the real pleasures of research, I mean, to some degree, copying a temple for two Roman gods and a mythical king. The gods aren't worshipped anymore. The king may not have existed. And we're copying a temple to them. It seems like a slightly odd task and a bit pointless on one level. But I think that the joy I get from it is my brain is following exactly the same paths that Phidias was all those thousands of years ago. I sort of feel that if I met him, we could have a good chat about how the volute worked and resolving the corner and which bit wasn't quite right. And it makes me feel that I'm part of a very ancient tradition. I'm sort of not an orphan. I find that very exciting. Okay.